I'd like us to turn to 1 Peter chapter 3. I will move along quickly here, but I want to talk about tools that build relationships. And with the young people in here, it's going to be a very fitting thing for them as well. Do we stop to think, what does it take to build a relationship? And that's the responsibility of all of us who are family members. As we said this morning, there is the undoing of God's plan. Genesis chapter 3, authority was questioned, turned into anarchy, attitude changed, it turned to accusation, and atmosphere changed, and it turned to agitation. If I were to walk into a family and I sense an atmosphere is caused by attitude that is caused by relationship to authority. If I walk into a church, if I walk into a corporate office, there's an atmosphere communicated that is attributed to attitudes in that place that's attributed to relationship with authority. That's the breakdown of that. A right relationship with authority has right attitudes that creates a right atmosphere. If I walk into a family and one person in that family is out of sorts with authority, the atmosphere is instantly tense. The attitude becomes very unfriendly and the authority structure is turned other than what God had intended for it. When man sinned, instantly a plan of redemption was put into place. Where Adam and Eve tried to cover themselves with leaves, God had an animal slain, blood was shed, coverings were made that were God's plan, ultimately picturing the payment for sin that would take place on the cross. Now, when a person gets saved, and he marries a person who is saved, both filled with the Spirit, can have what Adam and Eve had before the fall. And New Testament, Ephesians 5:18, be not drunk with wine, wherein is excess, but be filled. That is a clear-cut command. Now, filling will show itself in the family context of rejoicing, internal, external praise, mutual submission, the one to the other, and then a husband will love, a wife will submit, and a child will obey. That's the progression instantly following the command to be filled with the Spirit. It's in a family context. And a lot of wives will say, well, my husband, I don't know if my husband loves me. And it's like the old couple sitting on the porch swing. And they had been married, he had his arm around her. And she said, you remember what you used to do when we used to walk and hold hands? And she said, he said, yeah, I remember that. And remember when you used to, do so and so, and I remember that. Then she said, I remember when we were first married, you used to nibble on my ear. And he jumped up from that swing and he took off. She said, honey, I didn't mean to offend you. He said, no, if you want me to do that again, I have to go find my teeth. And so he said, yeah, we can get back to that. But I've got to go get some chompers. And probably left them in the glass. When you get older, your teeth are like the stars. They come out at night. And then she said, do you love me? You never tell me anymore. He said, when we stood at the altar 40 years ago, I told you I love you. And if I ever change my mind, you will be the first one to know about it. But isn't that funny, wives, when you go to your husband and say, I love you, he says, same here. I mean, that is really tender, isn't it? Same here. Or if he's an egotist, I don't blame you, baby. You have good taste. But a husband is to love, a wife is to submit. I define submission as ducking so God can hit your husband. And that's what we talked about a little bit earlier in that. Now we go, how does a Spirit-filled husband look? How does that love look? And what that looks like is what it takes for our relationships to work. And 1 Peter chapter 3, the first part is given to the wife there, for her commanded to have right actions, to have right adoration for her husband, a right adornment for her husband, a right attitude, and then paying attention to him, and then having her part in answered prayer. Then verse 7, likewise ye husbands. Now the guidelines that are given here, likewise ye husbands, dwell with them. And this is all one slide here that we have put up here. What does a spirit-filled husband do? A spirit-filled husband will live with her. Husbands dwell with them. In other words, the tool of time. Building the tool of time. That makes a big difference. That seemed like a strange command. You married her, now live with her. Well, that's a completely different thing. You remember Deuteronomy 24 and verse 5? What God commanded a man when he married under Mosaic law. Do you remember what God commanded him to do? Deuteronomy 24, 5. Okay, live with her. Don't go to war. Don't take any other responsibility. But cheer up your wife, which you have taken. And he was given one full year to make that happen. You know what that meant? It takes time to stabilize relationships. And there is an aspect of that that's very, very crucial. Oftentimes I say, well, as long as you get quality time, you don't need quantity time. Well, I've discovered you cannot have quality time without quantity time. Because quantity time to a dad, or a quality time to a dad, might not be the same as what is quality time to a son. Quality time for a dad might be, honey, let's get our Bibles. I'm going to lead you in a Bible study for 30 minutes. Where quality time to a son might be, dad, let's go fishing. And we sit in a boat and we talk about what the Lord is doing. But dad is showing that particular interest in that particular child at that point. So you live with her. And that command to stabilize that relationship. I remember I was driving, and this is benefit for the young people. And your responsibility is make sure you get time with mom and dad as well. But I think Stephen was maybe about 14 years old. And I said, Stephen, I'm going to ask you a question, and don't be afraid to be honest. What don't you like about me? He said, there's nothing I don't like about you. I said, I will not be hurt if you're honest. I really want to know if there's something about me. And he said, there's nothing about you. And he said, well, you're gone a lot. Well, at that time, carrying so much load with a large staff and traveling 80% of the weekends, and I thought, you know what, Stephen, I'll change that. And I'll do what I can do without, if it means quitting, then I'll quit. I'll go and do something else. And I realized I couldn't ethically drop any more things that I dropped. And so I took him out of school for a year. I said, you'll just travel with me. We were all over the world. Wailing Wall. I remember we were at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, and he loved that more than the Wailing Wall we had in our house. And because when I would spank him, I said, you put your hands behind you, that's going to be twice as bad. You put them there, and keep them there. And the Wailing Wall was there. Well, Wailing Wall in Jerusalem was nowhere near as bad. And even if we had to have a beanie on to go down there by that. But what was I trying to do? Because I realized the violation of the time factors. It's so easy to violate that. Even when we are together in the same place, it's easy to violate the time factor that is involved in that. And we take that for granted. I'll never forget coming back from California a while back with staffers. And this goes back about 3 weeks before 9/11, got a call from our kids. And all of our kids were home at that particular time. And they said, "We have mom at the hospital." I said, "What's the problem?" And they said, "Well, there's a pain, but they might have to observe her overnight." Well, Charlene had never been sick. And I thought, well, it can't be serious. Maybe a appendicitis or something, maybe. And I said, "Well," we pulled off to the side of the road there. My grandson was with me and a couple staffers, and we prayed on side the road there in L.A. And frankly, I thought, well, this is not going to be a major thing, but if anything changes, I said, let Northwest Airlines know, and then they can inform me when we get to Minneapolis. Well, landed in Minneapolis, and my name was announced, "Would you please pick up the white courtesy phone?" My heart just sank. I thought, this is not going to be good. And one of our staffers took the call and then came back and told me that your wife's heart exploded. That's what Northwest Airlines communicated the message. And I'm standing there thinking, did I just hear what I thought I heard? And I'm standing there thinking that Charlene is gone. From Denver just a few days earlier when she headed back and then we went out west. And I thought, how could that time be over? And I'm thinking, that time is gone. And I begged God, I said, "God, you're sovereign. I trust you. I beg you to let me keep my wife." God, sovereign, human panic. God, sovereign, human panic. And it was up and down that fast. The highs and the lows were that fast. And I, the next leg of that flight, I stared out the plane window and I thought, my mind was going a million miles an hour. But you know what was most conscious in my mind? That time was gone. The time frame was gone. I'm thinking, did I spend that time wisely? Did I do the right thing? Did I do these things wisely? I didn't want the plane to land. I knew when the wheels were to touch down that someone would meet the flight. Back then, you could still meet at the gate. It was just 3 weeks before 9/11. And when we landed, Tim and Barb Corey were there, and they said, "Charlene is still alive." In the meantime, while I was in the air, they had discovered that her descending aorta had dissected, and she was filling with blood, and it was 9 hours before she got into surgery. And she had been about 9 hours in surgery at that time when we got there. And the PA kept coming out and say, "Charlene is still alive. Charlene is still alive." And then later, the surgeon came out and said, "I want to meet with the family in the conference room." So all of us were there. And he said, "All I can tell you is Charlene is alive. We don't know how to predict brain damage for the amount of blood loss that went on. We don't know how to predict how long the paralysis is going to last because of where the terrorists took place. But all I can tell you now is she is still alive." That's all I needed to hear because there was that much of a window of time left. And when I was able to go in there the next morning and the green light came on in critical care, I walked up to her bed and she was partially conscious and she was moving her hand like this, like she wanted to write. So I told the nurse, I said, "I think she wants to write something." So they put a legal pad there and put a pen in her fingers and she wrote aneurysm clearly and accurately. I said, "She's smarter in a coma than I am in good health." I said, if you put a pen in my hand to write aneurysm, I couldn't spell it. And if I could, you couldn't read it after I did spell it. I said, "There's nothing wrong with her brain. Paralyzed on her left side. That eventually went away. No voice for many, many months." Doctor said, "I probably severed that nerve that feeds that vinyl, the cord, the vibrates to keep your vocal cords going." And But we'll deal with that later. All we know is she's alive. There's a long recovery thing. But you know what all of a sudden began to be aware of? Time. Young people, look at me. Spend time with your parents. You don't know when they're going to be gone. You slam doors, you'll regret every slam door. And you'll wish you had that much time left. The bitternesses that the arguments will mean absolutely nothing. They told our children, your mom is not going to make it. They were getting ready to load her in. A helicopter was coming in. The flight line was coming. And there were 70 mile an hour winds that day. They could not fly the chopper. They had to land it before they got to her. And that was of the Lord. And they got her ready to load into the ambulance. And they told the children, we need to be honest. We don't believe your mom is going to live. We want to give you a chance to say goodbye. If you picture this right now, young people, you're here and suddenly your healthy mom or your healthy dad is gone. But there's enough life left for you to have 3 minutes to say goodbye. What would you say in those 3 minutes? That was so stupid that you made me go to that Christian school. I hate you. No, it wouldn't be on your mind at all. Not at all. They told Charlene, she doesn't remember. My daughter Tammy was standing by the ambulance door and they loaded her in. And they told Tammy, they told Charlene that, we're going to be honest. We don't believe you can make it. We want to give you a chance to say goodbye to your children. Now, your mother, you're being loaded. You have 5 minutes to say goodbye to your children who are standing now gathered at an ambulance door while you're on a gurney being loaded in. What would be in your mind to share with that much time, 5 minutes of that massive thing, this continuum called time? You have 5 minutes to say that. What would you pack into that? Well, Charlene told Tammy, tell Dad I'm sorry this is happening now before school is beginning. I'm at peace. Then she told Tammy where $39 was hidden. Our retirement program, it's down to $23 now. Then the ambulance door closed and sped off. As we looked at the ambulance bill, it was 100 miles in, what was it, 47 minutes, wasn't it? 47 minutes to go 100 miles. My son tried keeping up. He got up to 115 miles an hour behind the ambulance and backed off. But you know what was on Stephen's mind? I'm not going to see Mom anymore. Put yourself in that situation, kids. All of a sudden, this hassle you're having with Mom and Dad now is going to be absolutely nothing. You will cry and cry and cry for 5 minutes to say, I love you. Time. Time. Charlene will remember well when we were called, when Dennis Pegram and Ina had their 9 children. 3 of the kids worked summer camp. Some of you know the Pegrams. And they were having a basketball. I had preached on time the night before. In fact, this very thing on tools, I was preaching that Thursday night. In fact, I totally changed the message I had planned to do that night. And I told Shirley, I'm going to speak on this thing called time. And I said, don't assume the person sitting next to you in the morning will be there when the sun goes down. And we finished chapel on Friday morning, dismissed at 12:20 for lunch, and then there was a basketball, afternoon basketball activity. All the families, kids and everybody playing basketball and the family basketball thing. Dennis was there. Dennis is 52 years old, good health, maintained himself well, ran, worked out regularly. And went up for a rebound at the end, and his body kept collapsed to the floor, and his soul continued on to glory. In fact, the policeman to whom he had witnessed, a lost couple there that week, he fell dead at this policeman's feet on the basketball court. And we got the call. We went back up to the hospital. We saw the ambulance going, and when Corey's called us, said that Dennis Pegram had a heart attack. We saw the ambulance with no lights driving slowly. We thought, Dennis is gone, and we got to the hospital. All nine children were there. And we started hugging and crying. Hugging and crying. Kids could not believe. Dad's on a gurney in his gym shorts and tennis shoes, full of life 30 minutes ago. But gone. How do you process all of that? I got to Ina when I was hugging Ina, the mom, and she said, you know, the last thing that Dennis and I did together, when you dismissed chapel this morning, Dennis said, honey, let's pray. And he put his arm around me and said, let's thank God for the time he has given us based on the message the night before, anticipating fully at least another 30 years together. And she said, that's the last thing we did. He prayed with me, thanking God for the time that we had. But suddenly, like that, nothing will take prominence. Remember a boy in our area, Pembine High School, that had odds with his family. Got a call, he was called from the classroom to the office, said, your dad had an accident at the mine. You need to come home. They got up to the hospital. Dad was in emergency room. The boy went, he was a big kid, he went through the emergency room doors, through the people, and said, you can't go in. He went literally laid on top of his father, said, Dad, you can't die. Because he knew there was not one opportunity he will have to ask his father's forgiveness for the attitude that he caused and the activity that he had caused. I say to us as parents, as grandparents, as great-grandparents, I say to you as children, don't abuse the time that God has given. Now, how does a husband do this? Dwell with them. Use the tool of time. Not only that, learn about her. This is the tool of thinking. Spend time thinking how you can meet the needs of another person. How can you meet the needs of another individual? In this context of the husband to the wife, he has to come to understand her. How does he think about her? How does he understand her? How does he function in light of the needs that are there for her? Think of how are you going to be thinking? Because God does give us insight in how these needs are. Young people, make a list of things. What can you do? How can you think of lifting your dad's or your mom's burden? How can you do that? Say, well, I'd like to have the house to myself for a while. Here's how you do that. Go home today, vacuum your room, pick up everything where your parents don't need a tetanus shot to go into your room. And then say, Mom, come here and look. And it's clean and pristine, and your mom will pass out. Ambulance will come. She's gone. Then bring your dad there. He passes out. They're both at the hospital. You got the house to yourself for a while. But at least you've done a good thing getting them out of the house. And all of their dumb rules that they have. You'll have one whole day of freedom. Learn about what makes your mom and dad happy. Learn that way. Then, husbands, learn what your wife needs. Wives, learn what your husband needs. You know, one of the best ways to develop an understanding heart is that you think about another person's need and how you can meet that, and then let another person come and meet that need. Learn the tool of thinking. Then, next, the tool of tenderness. The tool of tenderness. Husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife. Same word honor there is the command in Ephesians 6, for children are commanded to honor their parents, literally to consider them precious. Consider precious, the tenderness. What kind of things can you do? How can you exercise a tenderness? I remember doing a men's conference, and we were at this camp, and I told the men, I said, on the way home, show some tenderness to your wife. Stop and pick up a dozen of roses and take them to her. One guy said, well, she'll think I got the idea from here. I said, why do you think she paid to send you to this? Of course she'll know you got the idea here. That's why she sent you. Tenderness. How about a little note? How about just an encouraging note? And I want to tell you young people that the most precious possessions I have are notes from my kids. You know what? The little notes. But you know what's in those notes? Tenderness. Tender thoughts. Tender, I care about you, Mom. I care about you, Dad. Charlene has two poems that our daughter Tammy has written. One to Dad, and two poems that she has written to Mom for Mother's Day and for being a faithful. Some of you are given to, you might want, not want to try poetry. I don't know, you might end up making Mom depressed. But those of you who are able and given to that along those lines. But you know what? You know why they're posted in our living room? By the pictures of our daughter and her family and their kids, because it's a very tender thought that it would take for that to be put together. It doesn't cost you anything to be tender and to be thoughtful in that way. Love her. And that is a very clear tool. Think of ways you can do this. And then lead her. As unto the weaker vessel. This is a tool of a testimony that is there. Lead. Lead by example. I mean, we parents, and we talk and talk and talk, and well, we try to get the kids, when I was your age, you know how it was back in Indiana when it snowed winter and summer it snowed. Get 2 inches of snow and they call school off. We walked, and that was back when there was a law that no school could be any closer than 5 miles to the nearest home. And if the city didn't have a hill, they built one. And that schoolhouse perched right on the top of that hill. Snow. And we didn't worry about fancy clothes. And the kids behind our back are going like this. Pepsi generation being told by the Maalox crowd. Girls used to wear flower sacks. I do remember that. How many of you ladies remember Mom making your dresses out of flower sacks? We used to get these 100-pound orders of flour that Mom would bake with. And then we had sacks that would come. There were dress patterns in those sacks. One sister had to wait for 2 flower orders. But she would make dresses out of those flower sacks. But us boys had to wear cardboard. And you get heavy, wet snow. 12 months of snow. going to work in cardboard, and then windy, wet, and by the time you got to school, you were taking real short steps because there was not much left. And they say, oh boy, when I was your age, keep telling me all about the good old days. Boy, we can come up with some doozies, can't we? But you know what? Take advantage of it. Humor them. But if you young people, if any one of you have a bitterness in your soul, you will destroy yourself an inch at a time. You really will. Learn to love and learn to give and learn to be tender. And then learn to be a testimony to those people. And let mom and dad, let mom and dad talk. Because they said, well, I'll tell you what. We didn't have school buses. We walked. And guess what happened about 2:30 in the afternoon? That hill would tilt. And guess which way you had to walk to get home? Uphill. Lead. Testimony. You know, dads, we should be the ones giving out the gospel tracts as a test. We should be the ones witnessing. We should be the ones taking our wives and our children out, making calls, door knocking, or making follow-up calls. Lead. And then let me put one more before we close. Laugh with her. I call this the tool of being tickled. So I can keep all of my messages are illiterate. Some call them alliteration. I call mine illiterate. But learn how to laugh. I made a statement at a men's conference. I don't trust men who can't laugh. They're not holy, they're bitter. But one guy came up to me after. He said, I don't agree with you. And I almost said, no kidding, Tonto. He was sitting back there. And boy, a face tells a tale. Why is your countenance fallen? When Naomi came back out of Moab, well, back, is this Naomi? Your face is your own fault after you're 30 years old. Remember your mother used to say, you might get left like that. And some of you did. And I said, all I'm saying is, Proverbs says laughter is good like a medicine, and I just made the comment that I think laughter is a healer. I think it helps our system heal. I don't mean over unholy things or immoral things. I'm talking about laughter. We were in Redding, California, and a man came up to me. He said, boy, you tell a lot of jokes. We had been there for about 7 days today. I said, I do? I said, tell me one that I told. We had been there 7 days. I knew I hadn't told a single joke. Not even the Dear Aunt Emma story. I said, think real hard. I said, can you think of any? No. I said, I didn't tell any. He said, well, we were laughing. I said, I don't tell jokes. I describe life. Slightly exaggerated. That's the funniest thing going. Take reality and add a little bit of drama to it, and that's the funniest thing going. And I said, I don't tell jokes. I tell life. And every once in a while I'll tell a joke, but I never have a little... Sometimes Charlene said, boy, you were funny today. I said, how? Where? I don't have a note, be funny here, be funny. And sometimes things will come to my mind, and maybe it's the low IQ where they slip out. I'm not sure what drives all of that. That goes on. But you know, there is something healing about laughter. I saw that guy a year later. I got a letter from that guy about a year later. And it had a big article from one of the Detroit papers in it. And he had a note in the corner. You were right. It was from the medical section of one of either a Flint Journal or somewhere in the Detroit area. And he said, and it showed how they believe that science believes that laughter does put some kind of a healer into the system. I don't know anything about medicine, but I do know what Proverbs says. Laughter does good like a medicine. And men, if your wife comes home and the front end of the car is rearranged, you have to decide, do I want a good marriage or do I want a good car? At that point, you cannot have both. And think that car is going to be a beer can in Milwaukee in 5 years. But I'm still going to have my mate. Think quickly. Remember, I came back from deer hunting. I was out in my deer stand all morning, and I came home, and our daughter Lisa said, "Dad, I hit a deer with the car." It's what was it, a 6-point buck, honey? That she said, "I hit a deer with the car." And I said, "Weren't you looking? Or didn't you see it?" She said, "Yes, I saw it, so I floored it so I wouldn't miss it." Boy, that was a dumb question. Boy, she answered it with a dumb answer too. Of course I saw it. I floored it so I wouldn't miss it. That was loving dad, you know, you, without saying it. Driving with your eyes closed. No, I mean, deer run out and they don't send announcements ahead of time. But it becomes a real hearty har-har at times. But the laughter that I think is so healthy. I was raised in an unsaved family, but one thing we did do was laugh. And I was the last of 9 children. The oldest one died young. There were 8 of us. And when everybody was home, I mean, it was a time of laughter. Dad was a copper miner for over 40 years. And I think people that come out of hard backgrounds have a greater tendency to have a sense of humor. I think it, in many ways it becomes a means of survival to people. And I always detect when somebody has a sense of humor. I guarantee, I'll tell Charlene, I bet you they came out of a tough background somehow, some way. And normally that's true. Almost every professional comedian is a Jew. And boy, you know, any race that has been under more pressure, that they earned, pressure they earned through their disobedience. But let's learn the atmosphere of laughter. You know, when a home never has laughter in it, it's not a pleasant thing. You know, there are times that hit your families and there's no laugh there. And you have to stabilize and focus and pray and praise. But there are times when laughter is appropriate. It is very, very healthy and very, very healing to families. These are tools that I wanted to end with today. Tools that build our relationships. And we look at 1 Peter 3:7. Though I was directly a man to his wife, these tools fit every relationship. The God-man relationship, the father-son relationship, the parent relationship, the husband-wife relationship, church member to church member relationship. It takes time. It takes thinking. It takes tenderness. It takes a testimony for a body of believers to function together where these tools will grow us together in light of eternity. So let's take these tools and grow. I'm going to give you young people a project. I was in Pennsylvania speaking at a meeting, and on a Monday night, I challenged the teenagers during that VBS. I said, "I'm going to give you a dare. I dare you to go home and tell your mom and dad I love you." And I said, if you bigger boys are embarrassed about that, if your mom's at home in the kitchen when you get there, put your head in the kitchen and say, "Mom, I love you," and then run and hide. And I said, you know what she'll do when she comes to? She's going to come and say, "Did I hear what I thought I heard you say? Yes, Mom, I love you." So I dared them. Next night, Tuesday night, I said, "How many of you took my dare?" They did. I said, "Okay, what did your parents say?" One said, my dad said, "What do you want?" Another parent said, "Who put you up to this?" I thought, man, life, this must be a major project to go home and say, "I love you." That there's a big suspicion. Uh-oh, they're trying to get into my wallet now. Or now he wants to use the car. No, I love you, Dad. It's that simple. But you know, a lot of times coldness moves in and our hearts become hardened and we lose the sweetness. But we're not going to always have that time. My point is, use the tools that we have talked about here. Father, I pray that you will just impress on our hearts, even though the instruction you've given in this text is a man to his wife, yet your truth expands in all of our relationships that these tools will affect. Give us grace to do what you've given us to do, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.